Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Laura Lippman about her new book, Murder Takes a Vacation. We'll also hear from Robert Mann, whose new book is You Are My Sunshine, Jimmy Davis and the Biography of a Song. Laura Lippman is the New York Times bestselling author of nearly 30 novels and collections of essays and stories. She's won almost every award in her chosen field of crime fiction and has been called an essential crime writer. For me, and many women I know, she is an essential writer, period. In her most recent book, Murder Takes a Vacation, she resurrects Mrs. Blossom, a minor character who first appeared in the 2008 Tess Monahan novel, Another Thing to Fall. And what a joy it is to spend time with her when Murder Takes a Vacation. Laura Lippman, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Always a place I'm happy to be, for sure.
So happy to see Mrs. Blossom again in her lovely flowered outfits.
You know, this is kind of a selfish book because my intent when I wrote it was to write a book about a character that I wanted to spend time with, which was not true in my last two novels. The people were complicated, often quite awful, and I just needed a break. The irony is that it was the hardest book I've ever written, but the best company I've ever had while writing a book.
Ah, why was it so hard?
Cozies are hard. I mean, there's this old saying, I think, dying is easy, comedy is hard, about serious acting versus comic acting. And, you know, the cozy is a form, and I love forms. I love poetry. Mm-hmm. But if you think of the cozy as being something that has a kind of rigor to it, like a sonnet or a sestina or an apsidarian, when there are rules, and there are kind of rules to a cozy, expectations, things that have to be acknowledged. Mm-hmm. I mean, Raymond Chandler famously said, if you don't know what to do, send a character through the door with a gun.
Right.
You can't fall back on that in a cozy. There is an expectation that the violence will be less. There's definitely won't be gratuitous violence. There won't be extreme violence on the page. And, you know, you're supposed to be more polite in language and perhaps a little, you know, draw the curtain at sex. I found it to be a rigorous discipline and one I'm glad that I subjected myself to.
Which came first, wanting to revisit Mrs. Blossom or to write a cozy?
Mrs. Blossom. When Mrs. Blossom first appeared back in 2008, when we were almost 20 years apart in age. Funny how that happened.
Oh, yeah.
I got one letter from a reader who said he thought that I was a little bit ageist and pointed specifically to Mrs. Blossom's indifference, even incompetence with tech in that book. I take readers very seriously when they're polite. If someone takes the time to write an email that is serious and thoughtful, then I will listen to it and think about it. I don't extend that courtesy to people who are just hateful. Mm-hmm. I don't see any reason to engage. And I thought about it. I was like, well, I based Mrs. Blossom's dislike of tech on my own mother. And I don't think I'm being ageist. I think I'm just observing in my mom, who is a small extent inspired this character. My mom hated all forms of tech. She finally succumbed to the flip phone late in her life, and she could, you know, she had one of those big old phones that you can text on. My mom never used to, and she was a librarian. She's a serious person who knew how to do research. She just didn't like what she considered gadgets. So 2008, I'm like, I hear you, but I don't think you're quite right on this one criticism. But as I got older, I began to see, oh, I think I understand better, which is that this reader was bothered by seeing Mrs. Blossom through the POV of a much younger person who sometimes trivialized her or saw her as the butt of the joke. And now Mrs. Blossom and I are almost the same age. I don't want to be trivialized. I don't want to be the butt of the joke. How would I write about her differently if I'm inside her POV? And one night I was rewatching easily for the 15th time, and I might be underestimating it, the film Charade. And I had kind of this aha moment of, okay, Charade, but the older person is the woman and the younger person is the man. What happens now? How does it change?
Well, I did love it when she showed up with that huge cell phone the first time. It wasn't even a cell phone at all. It's just ginormous.
Phone.
And I did love her talent for surveillance. I mean,
that's respectful to her. That's
absolutely.
Her understanding what her superpower is. And in this book, she even takes it further. And I think the reader is told at one point that Mrs. Blossom realized that old people are so marginalized in our society that you can be doing surveillance and you can directly engage your subject. Like walk up to them with a map. Could you? And they're like, they don't want any part of you. They're just like, oh, you're old, you're difficult. And so she really has learned to turn everything into an advantage.
Well, you give her two things that are really essential for the good life. You give her money and you give her desire. But at the same time, she's lost her husband. So she's learning to live alone with these things.
Right. The money thing, I just thought it would be more fun.
Oh, like, it was. It was.
Let's give someone several $1 million and see what they do with it. I mean, she's 10 years out from the death of her husband, and she hasn't really recovered from it. She's sort of hidden from it. She's subverted the love and the care that she put into her marriage, into caring for her grandchildren. And now her daughter and her grandchildren are moving on literally and figuratively to a place where they don't need her anymore. And now here we have this woman at 68, the quintessential caretaker, and the person she has to learn to take care of is herself.
But she's got game. She really does.
She's super sexy. By the way, I would never describe myself that way, but it was so funny writing a character who's shy and, you know, not flamboyant, mm-hmm. not an anti-mame type character. And I'm writing this book and I was like, wait a minute, Mrs. Blossom is kind of sexy. She's on a low simmer all the time. And not every man is going to see that, and not every man is going to respond to it, but the men who see it, they really see it.
Now, you've also given her a passion for art, particularly the art of Joan Mitchell. And this year, we're celebrating Mitchell's centennial. So that's a really nice touch. So talk a little bit about Joan Mitchell's art and why you chose to illuminate it in this book.
Mrs. Blossom and I discovered Joan Mitchell in the exact same way. Oh. Which is to say, there was a show at the Baltimore Museum of Art. I think I'm pretty art savvy, especially when it comes to female abstract expressionists. And yet, I did not know of Joan Mitchell. I just didn't. I'm a little embarrassed about that, but hey, there it is. And it was a moment when, you know, we were kind of emerging from the darkest, most restrictive days of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And here was this show at the museum in the summertime. And I just wanted to go somewhere and do some things. And I actually went to the Joan Mitchell show with my daughter and my, by then, estranged heading to ex-husband, who also is a huge fan of abstract expressionists and had never heard of Joan Mitchell. And we walked into this exhibit. And, you know, in The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, you know, his heart grows.
Yeah.
My heart grew. I walked. I probably did almost cry the first time I saw Joan Mitchell's work, because it's beautiful and it's big and it's bold and it's joyful. And she was physically a tiny person, mm-hmm. but as an artist, I know now, having done a lot more research, that she was considered practically a prodigy in abstract art. And she took up so much space. And there's this thing about being a woman, whatever your physical size is, I happen to be a very tall, broad-shouldered woman with a big, loud laugh that's been commented on my whole life. And but whoever you are, I mean, if you're like the tiniest woman in the world, on some level, women have a complicated relationship with taking up space. And so to see these huge canvases that are, they're not shy, they're not reserved at all, it meant so much to me. And, you know, I kind of filed that away. And the following year, I became a docent at the American Visionary Art Museum, which is something I'm still doing. I lead tours every month at this gorgeous museum that happens to be in my neighborhood. And it's given my life this whole extra huge, I don't know how to describe it. It's mm-hmm. just the most wonderful thing. But yeah, in that moment, when Mrs. Blossom and I are almost completely the same person when it comes to Joan Mitchell and what she means to us and how we discovered her and how powerful her work is.
Now that you've had this lovely vacation with Mrs. Blossom, do you think she'll be back?
Oh, I'm 99.9% sure.
Oh, I'm so happy.
When I turned the book in, both my U.S. and my U.K. editor said, "And will there be more?" And I said, "If you want them, there can be more." And because of the way I work, I started another book that was very, very different and is, you know, dark and weird, and I've been struggling with it, feels like a year now, probably about a year now. But I have opened a little folder where I have two very pretty defined ideas for Mrs. Blossom. So I would like to take Mrs. Blossom to Tuscany.
Ooh.
A place I've spent a lot of time because I teach there in a kind of like a writing retreat run by Anne Hood. Mm-hmm. I would like to take her to Ireland and probably beyond that. But those, I have at least two pretty firm ideas that also borrow from the Christie canon.
Oh, happiness. Oh, that is pure happiness. Thank you so much.
I like hearing that.
Oh, that will be great. I can't wait. We've been talking with Laura Lippman, whose delightful new book is Murder Takes a Vacation. It's a vacation. It's Paris. It's art. It's great food. It's everything you want. It's full of charm, but it's full of wisdom, too. Laura, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Susan.
Robert Mann is the author of 10 books on United States and Louisiana political history. He was a senior aide to U.S. Senators Russell Long and John Brough, as well as Louisiana Governor Kathleen Babineau Blanco. He served on the faculty of the Manship School of Mass Communications at LSU for 18 years before retiring in 2024. Today, we're talking about his new book, You Are My Sunshine, Jimmy Davis and the Biography of a Song. Bob Mann, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Great to be back with you.
You know, I was thinking about your book, Kingfish U, and Huey Long's great affection for the LSU marching band. And that made me wonder if any other state turns out as many politician entertainers as Louisiana does.
That's a good question. I haven't thought of it in that realm, but I think that we definitely like our music and we definitely love our politics. And some of the most successful politicians have indeed found a way to fused the two, and Jimmy Davis was certainly one of them, and Huey Long was another.
But I mean, like coroners, district attorneys.
That's right.
A lot of folks have to get up on stage. So talk about the origin of this book and what drew you to this story.
Well, originally, it was a book it was going to be a very short book about how the song became the state song in 1977, And it quickly became a lens through which to look at a lot of Louisiana history, political history in the 40s and 50s and 60s, including the civil rights movement even. And then as I dug deeper, I realized that it was also a story of the birth of country music. I had always assumed that Jimmy Davis was just a one-hit wonder, that his Sunshine was pretty much it for him. I knew a few of his other songs, but you know, it was seemed like that he just built his whole career around Sunshine. And what I learned was that, no, indeed, when he recorded Sunshine for the first time, he'd already had several hits, and he had other hits after that. He was a very successful country music singer and truly did earn his place in the Country Music Hall of Fame, and it wasn't just because of this one song, as I had mistakenly assumed.
You know, when my husband was at Vanderbilt, he was a tour guide in the Country Music Hall of Fame. So he knows You Are My Sunshine. He did know You Are My Sunshine very well. But the story of this song just twists and turns right from the very beginning. The origin story of the song is a little cloudy, although I myself am a little partial to the redheaded woman version.
Yeah, she's the mystery woman of the story, and no one knows for sure who she was. We, as I write in the book, I and some of the grandchildren of Oliver Hood, who I believe was the real writer of the song, believe they know who it was. That it was someone that the person who wrote Sunshine had a relationship with, and she basically took the song and shared it with other musicians in and around Atlanta, and it eventually wound up in Shreveport in Jimmy Davis's hands. But it was clearly a song that was floating around Georgia, the Atlanta area, for maybe as many as 10 years before Jimmy Davis heard about it. But I do believe that the common thread through a lot of that early conduit of that music was this mysterious red-haired girl.
And you do so much to explain how music works, you know, the whole business of you can own a song, you can perform a song, how that works. And that must have been something different for you.
Yeah, I felt like I needed to retain an entertainment lawyer to
an intellectual
it.
Property.
Yeah, it's still a little hard to keep straight because it's very complicated stuff. But I think one thing I learned is that if I hadn't taken the time to learn some of that, I might have judged Jimmy Davis a little more harshly than he should be judged, because you know, a lot of people that I talked to about the song, they're surprised he didn't write it. They're surprised that he bought it for $35, that he claimed that it was his own for a long time. And what I learned through looking through the early history of musical intellectual property, was that practice, while it would be frowned on today, it wasn't that unusual in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as late as the 80s, the Beatles lost control of all their musical catalog, all their songs. They no longer own their own music. It's not unheard of for someone to write a really popular song and lose control of it.
And it's a song that became a campaign standard. Even when people didn't want to hear it, Jimmy Davis would play it.
Yeah, and I think that the thing about Sunshine was that it was so helpful to establish Davis as this wholesome character, singer of you know, what we now know as a lullaby that a lot of us have sung to our children and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But it was really those Sunshine and songs like that, when he was running for governor the first time, were really useful to him in crafting this image of this upright, cowboy, you know, the noble cowboy, singing cowboy figure. When in fact, less than 10 years earlier, he had been recording and releasing some of the raunchiest songs that anybody's ever heard. Some of these songs you still probably would have trouble getting them on the air because they were just really raunchy stuff. And Sunshine, as much as any song that he recorded, helped him overcome the potential danger to his political career of that early music that he recorded.
Now, talk a little bit about the complicated race relations of the period that as they worked with the song. That was such an interesting thing to read.
Are you talking about in the 40s, or are you talking about the race relations in the 60s?
Well, both, really.
Okay. Well, so, you know, it's interesting that, you know, Davis was a pioneer in the sort of the integration of the music industry. He had, when he was in Shreveport, where I'm, by the way, where I am right now.
I know.
when he was recording in Shreveport and playing around in and around Shreveport, it was not unusual for him to be seen in the company of black artists and black musicians. In fact, he is the first country, in those days it was hillbilly, called hillbilly, but he's the first country artist to record, white country artist, to record with a black musician. He's the first white country artist to record a vocal duo with a black singer. So he was a real groundbreaker, and he was willing to cross those racial barriers. He wasn't ashamed to be seen, even in the 1930s and 40s with black entertainers. You know, fast forward in the book to the 1960s. You know, he becomes one of the leading segregationist governors in the South. As I write in the book, his pro-segregation record ends up hurting his song. The song becomes the anthem of one of the nation's foremost segregationists, and it took Ray Charles
to redeem
the song and sort of pull it out of its segregationist purgatory.
And you make a point of how Sunshine infused other popular music coming later after this song.
Yes, especially after Charles records it. It becomes a song that black entertainers are more willing to record. I think it was stayed mostly in the domain of white singers, of white sort of country, maybe pop singers, because of Davis's association with the segregation movement in Louisiana and the South. I think that the song would not have been acceptable to a lot of black artists after 1960, 61, 62. But Ray Charles had the ability to take the song, put a new melody to it, you know, to just completely reinvent it in a way that made it acceptable to black artists. And when black artists start recording the song, 62 on, they're recording it mostly using the tune of Ray Charles, not of the original tune that Jimmy Davis recorded in 1940.
Isn't that interesting? Now, tell me about the writing of this book. I have this vision of you sitting at your desk with headphones on, listening to all this music.
I did listen to a lot of music, and it's really helpful that so much music has been preserved. Some of all that early music from 1929 on that Davis was recording, and a lot of the other early country music hillbilly artists. You can go to YouTube, and someone somewhere has downloaded or uploaded at least one version of every song that I was looking for was at my fingertips. Which is, you know, if I had thought about writing this book 20 years ago, it would have been an impossible task. It would have taken me twice as long to track down all this music. But it's now everything's online. It really helped a lot, and it's also been helpful for me when I go around and speak. I can tell people about the music and say, just go Google it, you'll find it, and they're able to listen to the music.
Well, it's such an interesting chapter of Louisiana history, you know, our entertainment history and our human history, obviously. So what did it teach you about writing? This is something new for you? It's a different kind of book?
Well, I was a little intimidated at first because I'm pretty comfortable writing about politics, but I'd never written about music and musicology. I'd never had to really describe music or think about how to assess a song. I knew a little bit about country music. I'm a big country music fan, so I knew a lot about the artists that I was writing about. I knew them. I knew the names, and but the music part was different for me. And I actually found an editor who had edited a number of books on popular music and paid him to read one of the early drafts just to make sure that I was not completely missing anything or that I was, you know, using the lingo that musicologists would recognize and not making any big mistakes. And so that helped a lot. But it was fun because I was felt like I was using some muscles that I had not used before and developed. It's made me want to write more about music. It's made me want to write more about the history of country music. There's some seminal country music stars who were recording during Davis's era that I think deserve a full-scale biography. Somebody like Roy Acuff, who has never had a really decent biography. It's made me want to maybe consider writing something about one of those people.
Oh, I can't wait. New directions.
Yeah.
Oh, we've been talking with Bob Mann about his new book, You Are My Sunshine, Jimmy Davis and the Biography of a Song. What a trip down memory lane this was, Bob. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a joy.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Laura Carroll presents a story time, Go Boudreaux, Saturday, June 28th at 11 at Garden District Bookshop. Elise Burke discusses and signs Chase Harlem, Saturday, June 28th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Pam Abel, a longtime writer and reader of fiction, will present Long Story Short, Why and How to Write and Market Short Stories from 1 to 3:30, Monday, June 30th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, free of charge and open to the public. Registration not required. Frank Perez, author of Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis, Robert Fiesler, author of American Scare, and Larry Bagnaris, author of Call Me Larry, appear Monday, June 30th at 6 p.m. at BK House and Gardens for a book signing, celebrating Pride Month. Carol Mosley Braun, the first female African-American senator, signs her book, Trailblazer, Perseverance in Life and Politics, Tuesday, July 1st at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Jessica Rareside, a career coach with her company Rare Insight, will lead a seminar on resume writing geared for veterans, Tuesday, July 1st at 6:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Brenda Palmer discusses and signs Yes, the Everyday Adventure of Radical Obedience, Thursday, July 3rd at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.